Let's play some cards.
From Harrah's St. Louis Casino and Hotel, this is The Final Table, starring professional poker player Dennis Phillips and Paul Harrah's.
Winner, winner, chicken dinner!
Wow, winning.
Now, from the Harrah's St. Louis Poker Room, here are Dennis and Paul on 590 The Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com.
Coming up on the show today, some tournament stories, an update on last week's congressional hearings on licensing and regulating online poker, and the latest on when Full Tilt players might get some of their money back. All that ahead of the course in the next hour or so. I am Paul Harrah's, sitting at the feature table in the Harrah's St. Louis Poker Room. My partner Dennis Phillips will join me in a few minutes. By the way, the Bad Beat jackpot here is almost up to $112,000. And we are just 9 days away from the start of a tournament series here at Harrah's St. Louis called the Gateway Poker Classic. And I've been getting lots of people who've been texting and emailing and leaving me messages on Twitter as well, people who want to know what the schedule is. We're going to run down the schedule of events for this Gateway Poker Classic a little bit later on in the show. Dennis has been traveling like crazy once again for a guy who just had emergency appendectomy surgery about a month ago. He has not been laying low and taking it easy. The doctors told him, 8 to 10 days bed rest. And Dennis said, okay, I heard you, 4 days bed rest. I'm out of here. Where have you been since I talked to you last, Dennis?
Oh, well, I couldn't pass up the chance to go over to the Hollywood Casino over there in Indiana, Lawrenceburg. Went over there. Chad Brown was there. Greg Raymer was there. The Grinder was there. We had some fun, played some poker, good time over there.
Was this the Hollywood Fall Classic?
Absolutely was. I played in a couple of events over there. Greg played in several more. He was there for a few days longer. None of us, this is embarrassing, none of us made it through day one on their main event.
Wow.
I think Greg lasted the longest, but we all got coolered or put out in some way or another right down the line. They had a good, solid turnout, not quite as big as their last event, but they had almost 200 people in the main. Nice prize pool. I think their first event, they had 1,400 people in it for their $300 one. So, again, just a massive amount of poker over there. Kevin Dawn, the gentleman who runs the poker room over there and the tournament director, takes care of everything and takes care of the people, and you enjoy going back there.
Yeah, it's a fun place to go. I was there with you last year for the Hollywood Fall Classic, made a final table there, and you and I were back there a few months ago as well, and they do a very nice job of running things there. And I heard that Chino Ream showed up at one point, which I guess means he found some more money somewhere after paying everybody off from his epic poker win earlier this fall.
Excuse me, I apologize for the call. Chino was there, talked to him a little bit. He and, if I understand this right, he and the Grinder got in about 3 o'clock in the morning. They were having a deep stack seminar the following night at 5. However, they didn't go straight to bed. At about 7 in the morning, they finally left the poker room or the slot room or wherever the heck they were playing at that particular time, went up to bed, and the Grinder, with 8 o'clock, 45 minutes later, was on a radio show being interviewed.
Uh-huh.
Then they finally crashed, did their deep stack thing that night, played some more poker, got up the next day, back to the tables, play in the main event. Chino never left the tables. He was there to play poker.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was the first one out of the main event, too.
Well, you know what? With Chino's style, he plays a kind of a slash-and-burn style. He's either going to get a lot of chips early, or he's going to be out and sitting in a cash game somewhere.
And to be truthful, there's something to be said for that. Because there's nothing worse than you go a day and a half in a tournament and get, out, 10, 20, 30 people from the money, and you make absolutely nothing for it. So
yeah,
you grind it, and make nothing. Chino normally doesn't do that. You're absolutely right. If he's going to make it into the money, he's probably going to have a pile of chips in front of him.
Well, you know what? I kind of take the same attitude. As you know, I don't want to sit there for a day and a half or make it a few hours into day two and min cash, or maybe make it one or two levels above min cash where I'm just making a little bit of a return on my money. When I played that first event up in Hammond in October, at a certain point, I realized I had been playing in the tournament for 15 hours and my total net take was something like $500 above the buy-in, and if I had played 15 hours in the PLO or the 5-10 no-limit games there, I would expect my return would be a little bit higher than that. So I kind of am, you know, I'm not a tournament grinder. I can't sit there and take the action and the slowness of the action that a tournament will bring for 2 days for such a small payout. I would much rather either accumulate a lot of chips early on or get me into a cash game where I think my chances are probably better. But then again, I'm mostly a cash game player.
Yeah. And the thing of it is, if you do grind out and you make it in the money and you play solid and you make it to a final table, then the returns can be very, very nice.
Right.
But you do need to run deeper than just making the money. A mid-cash doesn't get you a whole lot.
Absolutely right. All right, a couple of other things I want to mention. Last week you told a story about a hand you had never seen before in all the years you've been playing poker, in which you and another player folded a pair pre-flop. Two other guys got into it for all their money with aces versus kings. You folded nines. Another player folded eights. The flop came out ace, king, nine. The turn was an eight, and the river was a king. So, in effect, you had quads over over a set, over a set, over a set. And you said, I don't even know how to begin to calculate the odds on that. Well, a couple of our listeners did, and I haven't done any of the math here to check this out, but our friend Jeff Roper, who won the 2010 World Series of Poker Circuit of Main Event here at Harrah's St. Louis, he did some of the math, and he said the odds of getting any quads, any four-pair dealt turning into quads over set, over set, over set, are about 8 million to 1. Another friend of ours here in St. Louis, Bob Riley, known as BR, said if you set it out to be those specific pairs, aces, kings, nines, and eights, the odds are something like 10.7 trillion to 1. So, again, I haven't gone back and checked their math or anything, but thanks to them for doing the calculations, and you truly did see a rarity there at table.
I'll see another one next week, I'm sure.
Yeah, you know,
yeah, right.
That's but you know what? We always say this in all the years that we've been playing poker. You always say to yourself, well, now I've seen everything. And then another year goes by and you go, well, I was wrong. Now I've seen everything. And on and on and on. And before we get into some of the full tilt stuff, I want to mention that I saw a little bit of the Epic Poker broadcast on Saturday afternoon on CBS. This is that time buy that we talked about with Andy Duke and Jeffrey Pollack. They're on that Velocity channel. And I think they're on four or six Saturdays on the CBS Sports Spectacular, as they call it. And I saw a little bit of it, and I got to tell you, having sat through the live coverage of the main event of the World Series of Poker, which we talked about last week with Lon McCarron, and we talked about in depth 2 weeks ago when it was still going on, getting used to the pace of live poker as a player and then getting used to seeing it on TV and on the streams this summer and on ESPN and ESPN2, where you actually got to see all of the hands. I now can't watch the pre-recorded, edited highlight shows like what Epic Poker put on for an hour on Saturday. Even though when the show started, it was only four players left, to me, it was like, you know, frankly, any average second hour of a World Poker Tour telecast where it's still not really poker, it's poker highlights. Has your attitude at all been changed by some of this see every hand near live coverage?
Well, again, but ours is a little jaded because we're poker players. We want to see the action. We want to see how it develops. I definitely prefer that. When I see a highlight, even in the past, before all these others came out, when you'd see a highlight, it's like Lon was saying last week. They're going to do a highlight reel of the final table, and the first thing you have to show is the eight hands that everybody busted out on. whether they're interesting or not, that's eight hands. That's going to take a chunk of it. That leaves you very little time then to show anything else on the developments. And all you show are many times either the suck outs that come or the all-in pushes. You don't see the finesse. You don't see the actual play. You don't see the relationship grow in the play between two players. Huge, huge difference.
Yep, absolutely. And while we're talking about televised poker, Guy La Liberté, the guy behind Cirque du Soleil, who many of us saw playing a few years ago on high-stakes poker, and of course those high-stakes cash game players love it when a billionaire sits down, although Guy had a few times when he sat down there and just ran right over the table. He has worked with the World Series of Poker to put together a big million-dollar buy-in charity event for his One Drop charity. That's a clean water charity that helps provide clean water, drinking water, for people all around the world. And they're still working on this. He would like to get 48 people to play. The latest count on this is that 22 players have all agreed to cough up $1 million. Of that million, $111,111 will go to the charity. Here are some of the players who are in there. So you can decide whether you want to play against this competition.
Okay.
Doyle Brunson, Gus Hansen, the billionaire banker Andy Beal, Jonathan Duhamel, Bobby Baldwin, for whom Bobby's name at the Bellagio is named, Phil Ruffin, the owner of Treasure Island, Patrick Antonius, Elke, and Tony G. That's just some of the 22 who have announced. They want to get that number up to 48. If they do, the winner will get $17 million. $17 million as your first place payoff, plus not a gold bracelet, but a platinum bracelet. And another different thing about this tournament is normally 10% of the field of any tournament gets paid. Some make it smaller, 8%. Some tournaments take it up to 11 or 12%. But in this case, 20% of the field is going to get paid. This is going to be broadcast on ESPN, and I hope we get more than just 1 hour out of that, because this could be very interesting, considering that they start with 3 million in starting chips. Because at the WSOP, it's all triple starting chips. You pay $1,000, you get $3,000. You pay $10,000, you get $30,000. You pay $1 million, you get $3 million. Although I'm guessing the first blinds aren't $25.50.
Well, they may not be, but I'm also guessing if you miss the first hour, you're not going to be hurt too bad on your stack.
Yeah. I don't know what the buy-in is going to be, but, you know, we've talked about high roller events, and when there was a $25,000 event, I asked you, could they go higher, and you said yes. And then there was a $100,000 buy-in event. Could it go higher? You said yes. Then there was a $250,000 buy-in event. We haven't talked about the question of could it go higher, but the answer, of course, now is yes. You've got 22 guys willing to put $1 million into the prize pool. Now, some of these pros, of course, are looking at Guy La Liberté and Andy Beal and Phil Ruffin and some of these other big, deep-pocketed business people as being the fish who will be part of the field. But still, we're talking about a one, a two commas, and six zeros in the check you're going to write for your buy-in. There's a limited number of people who can do that.
There really is, and I think you're going to be split probably evenly. About half of them will be pros, and about half of them will be businessmen who want to get involved in it. Doyle once said, when they asked him, what stakes do you want to play for? And he says, whatever stakes makes my opponent uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Well, at this million-dollar stake, some of these pros, some of the people that you maybe not the ones you've named, but some of the people who will end up getting in there are going to be uncomfortable playing for it. There will be a little bit of an advantage to a Guy who can lose $1 million and probably not lose any sleep over it.
Yeah, for him, that is one drop.
Exactly, exactly. It is not for the bankroll of a poker player. I don't care who you are.
Yep.
So this may actually give, it is such a high stake, it may actually give a little bit of an advantage back to the amateurs, back to Phil Ruffin or somebody who can afford this without any major problems. They'll just find a way to write it off on their taxes or something. And I'm telling you, I don't care whether you're Patrick or Duhamel or whoever, $1 million is a chunk out of your bankroll. And you're going to at least think twice before you shove it in there with a king three.
Yep. You know, Jonathan Duhamel picked up a nice check for winning the main event last year. And he's got a nice deal with PokerStars, and he probably has some other endorsement deals. But there's no way he has the bankroll for $1 million buy-in.
Correct.
I mean, does he have $1 million? Yes. Is his bankroll big enough to support buying into any one event for $1 million? I don't think so.
No. I mean, if you're never supposed to buy into any event that's going to take more than like 5% or at maximum 10% of your bankroll, he does not have a $10 million bankroll sitting around to do nothing but play poker with.
Right.
So, it's definitely over the top for almost any pro to even consider playing in. Greg Raymer would have a field day telling you about how idiotic you are to put that much of money into one tournament.
Yep.
And truthfully, it's hard to argue with his logic. But there are people to do it. Heck, I'd be tempted to do it. But, you know, $1 million, that's just a little higher than any of us are used to playing for.
Well, you know, you talk about the rich, deep-pocketed business people wanted to play at stakes that would be uncomfortable for the poker pros. That was Andy Beal's entire attitude when he played against the so-called corporation in those legendary limit poker games out at Bobby's Room, where he, you know, they wanted to play 5,000, 10,000, or 10,000, 20,000. He wanted to push it to 50,000, 100,000, because he knew he's a billionaire. It didn't really mean all that much to him except pride and the ability to get better at the game of poker and prove that he was a real poker player. You get up to those stakes, and even if you're a Jennifer Harmon or a Todd Brunson or a Doyle Brunson or a Barry Greenstein or a Johnny Chan, all these people who were members of the corporation, you're starting to get towards a point where they are sweating the dollars.
Yeah. It absolutely is. I mean, there is a limit to every bankroll.
Yep.
Maybe Guy hasn't found his yet, but, you know, this is pushing to the upper limits. There's no doubt about it.
This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show. He's Dennis Phillips in Las Vegas. I'm Paul Harris at the feature table in the poker room of Harris St. Louis. Let's talk about some good news for poker players, which is the Full Tilt deal that was announced last week. Now, this does not mean that if you have money in a Full Tilt account, you're going to get a check before Thanksgiving or Christmas or, you know, New Year's. What it does mean is that the United States Department of Justice is, according to sources, close to finalizing a deal with the French group Bernard Tapie, which wants to buy Full Tilt Poker. The Bernard Tapie group would pay $80 million for assets of the company, and they would be responsible for paying back all the Full Tilt players outside of the United States. The money for players inside the United States, which is the majority of Full Tilt's player base, would be paid back out of the money that the DOJ has seized or gotten from Full Tilt selling all of its assets. Full Tilt would have to agree to forfeit all of its assets to the United States, and none of the current Full Tilt directors, that's Ray Bitar, Howard Lederer, Chris Ferguson, Ray First, they would not be allowed to hold shares in the company. Some of the other shareholders who are out there, your Phil Gordons and Mike Matisau's and Phil Ivey's and Jennifer Harmon's, they could own shares in the new company. But the people who have been named in these indictments would not be able to own any piece of it. So now the Full Tilt shareholders haven't done this yet, but they have to have a vote on whether they will accept this deal, forfeiting everything that they have in exchange for the new company paying $80 million, which would then turn around and be paid out to European and Asian and South American players, while the American players would have to petition, effectively, the Department of Justice. And I guess that Full Tilt would have to turn over its player database information so that the government would know who is entitled to compensation and who is not. When this whole thing started, and I told you first, Dennis, on this show about Group Bernard Tapie and their history and who these people were, you said, frankly, I don't care who they are as long as the players are going to get their money back. Is this all good news for players? Forget about the directors and the others at Full Tilt. Is this good news for players?
Well, it's at least a possibility now. But I don't want people to get overly optimistic and you read headlines about Full Tilt sold and everything. It is not yet. In fact, a spokesperson with the DOJ came out yesterday and said, when asked specifically about it, said, "We have no comment and are not confirming or denying an agreement with this group." So until the DOJ comes out and makes a statement, not just Bernard Tapie's group, I'm very hesitant on it. There's also several other problems to it. About a week ago, finally, a little more than a week and a half ago, Chris Ferguson's attorneys came up with a response to some of the allegations and everything in it. And in it, he petitioned, he filed numerous motions actually, but he petitioned to have to lay claim to a mess of the seized assets. Now, some of them, they even listed amounts. There were $98 million that were seized in two of the sub-companies that are operated by Full Tilt that he claimed was money that was in there and waiting to be returned to Full Tilt players. So that $98 million, if I'm reading this right, was actual players' deposits that he was saying should be returned to the players. However, through Tiltware, the parent company of it, he also laid claim to various bank accounts that totaled over $196 million. And those were identified as European. Two of the accounts were at that SunFirst Bank in Utah, a variety of other ones around there. On this one, he doesn't say where the money goes, doesn't say whose money it is or what would happen with it and everything. There was also another 11 bank accounts that were named in this that he was asking to be turned back that they didn't list the amounts in. So now then, I had no clue how much money the government seized or anything like that. Without those additional 11 ones, that's $300 million that he says the government has seized already. So I guess the $150 million to the players, they do have that money seized, if you can believe this. And if he and Howard and the rest of them don't contest this and turn this over to the DOJ, and the DOJ then sells it to the $80 million for the Tapie Group, which brings in even additional funds, they can pay, I guess, that $150 million back to the players. So I guess there is a chance to do this, but there's going to be a hell of a lot more negotiation going on. I cannot see this being resolved for another 6 months or a year even, probably, before everything gets worked out and people could expect their money. Do not count on this as a Christmas bonus. It isn't coming.
But if they have all of that money in the sub-companies of Full Tilt Poker, then why were they not able to pay players back themselves after Black Friday? Remember that although the government did seize assets, PokerStars assets were also seized, but they made a deal saying, hey, you know what, let us at least pay back the U.S. players out of those funds, and they did. If Full Tilt had that money, as opposed to the story where they only had $60 million and owed 440, or no, they owed $390 million but only had 60 that they could do anything with, if they really had all the money you're talking about and all those accounts that Ferguson has laid claim to, why weren't they paying players back?
Well, again, I'm not on the inside knowing this. My guess would be that these were not, quote, clean funds. PokerStars money was held. Every time you made a deposit on PokerStars, it went into a separate bank account, was never touched by corporate, never commingled at all. That money could be proved and traced, every penny of it, back to a deposit. In other words, if they had $100 in this bank account, they could say it belongs to players A, B, C, and D, period. That's it. There's your money. There's you trace it. Full Tilt could not do that. Therefore, it wasn't clean money. And therefore, when the DOJ seized it, they turned around to Full Tilt, my understanding is, and said, you prove that this is all player deposit money before we release it. And Full Tilt could not do that.
One of the parts of this agreement, as I mentioned, is that the U.S. customer list of Full Tilt Poker is considered part of the assets, but
yes,
that the group Bernard Tapie wouldn't be able to use those assets in the United States, that the DOJ could use it to identify who is owed money and who is not owed money. But Jeff Ifra, who's the lawyer for Full Tilt, said that the deal with the DOJ, again, we don't have confirmation from the DOJ, as you pointed out, but he says that the deal with the DOJ specifically permits the re-entry of Full Tilt,
yes,
into the U.S. marketplace if online poker becomes legalized and regulated. They'd have to apply for a license, but that they would not be shunned by the licensing organizations just because of what happened pre-Black Friday. Does PokerStars have a deal like that, that they're guaranteed to be considered for a license?
See, this is the irony of it that maybe that just really, really could stink. What they're saying is these guys may find a way to back out of it and get away from it. Granted, they'll get the players their money back, so it might be worth it. But then they're giving a clean bill of health to Full Tilt to, if this law is in Washington passed, to come back into it. But because PokerStars sent the money back, I've not seen anything negative about PokerStars hardly on this whole deal. And they're not going to be allowed back in because there's still these indictments against them. How bad is that?
In other words, the company that acted properly and responsibly with players'
correct.
Money above all the rest of these, more than
correct.
Full Tilt, more than AP, more than UB, they might get screwed.
Yes, absolutely. That would just be so horrendous. Let's do everything right, and then we'll be the ones that can stand on the sidelines.
Now, I mentioned UB and AP. That's Ultimate Bet and Absolute Poker.
Yeah.
I hear stories about them, and there have been headlines in the last few weeks about how UB could be paying back players even before Full Tilt Poker.
Correct.
What do you know about this?
Well, again, my understanding, and if some of the listeners have something to correct me on this, that's fine. My understanding is that the parent company, the company that bought these in August of 2010, that basically got handed a very nasty business.
That's Blanca.
Also owns some other company.
That company's called Blanca Games. They bought it.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yep.
Blanca Games. They're kind of between a rock and a hard spot. As it stands right now, because they did buy the company, they're the ones liable, and they're the ones that are going to be prohibited from ever participating again in the U.S. unless they can find some way around it. However, there are no assets. The people that had it, I assume, have absconded with it, and so that there isn't assets within UB or to pay the players back, and that's to the tune of $50 million, they're guessing. So what? This parent company is now proposing to do, because they own other online companies that were not, smeared in with this group.
Yep.
They're saying that they will sell their assets. They will do everything possible they can to raise this $50 million, give it back to the players, but give us a clean bill of health, because we're the ones that walked into this in August of 2010. So we're willing to sacrifice the assets of our company to pay the players back. But by doing that, we want a clean bill of health, too.
Wow.
So the people that took the money and are living in Panama right now may get away from this thing scot-free.
Now, this does not eradicate the legal problems for Chris Ferguson and Howard Lederer and others who have been named in the indictment, nor for the people
correct.
From PokerStars and the other groups who have been named in these indictments by the U.S. Department of Justice, Southern District of New York, right?
It does not, but it does bring a lot of things into question. If Chris Ferguson is contesting and trying to claim that this $300 million should be released back to Full Tilt or to the directors, then there might be some high-level meeting in which they'd say, look, let's see if we can get this thing resolved. You forfeit all rights to these assets. That enables us to send the money back to the players. That enables us to keep whatever balance is left. That enables us to sell the remaining assets to the Bernard Tappy Group for the $80 million. And in return for that, maybe they won't prosecute them or something, or maybe they'll reduce the charges, or I don't know. But I'll bet you this ends up some high-level negotiation with about 20 attorneys sitting there around the table.
Yep.
And, what comes out of it, we may never know, because it might even be sealed.
All right. Well, our guest may know a little bit more about this. We're going to take a quick break here, and then we're going to be joined by Rich Muni from the Poker Players Alliance, who may be able to fill us in a little bit more on this story, as well as the efforts in Congress to move forward some legislation that would help license and regulate online poker in the United States. We know that we haven't really been paying attention to this story over the last 2 or 3 weeks because we've been doing such in-depth coverage of the main event, and also last week with Barry Greenstein and the Hall of Fame and all that sort of stuff. So that's what today's show is really focusing on, and we'll do that with Rich in just a couple of minutes. First, let me tell you about the Gateway Poker Classic, which starts in 9 days here at Harrah's St. Louis. It is going to be a 34-event, 11-day run. We're talking about 19 different no-limit events, not counting the Jack and Jill event and the seniors event and the ladies event. 19 other no-limit events, plus, by my count, a half a dozen pot limit events, and there's a horse event in there. You got Omaha High Low in there. You've got pretty much every level of buy-in you would want. The 7 o'clock evening events each day are $125 to buy in. The noon events each day will be $355 or $245 or $565, all leading up to the No Limit Hold'em Championship event, a two-day event on Saturday, December 10th, which will be an $1,100 buy-in event. We know that people are going to be coming from outside the St. Louis area, and we look forward to having you here. There are still some rooms available at the Harrah's St. Louis Hotel if you'd like to stay here. There's a brand new steakhouse that's opened up here you can try out called the Kelly English Steakhouse. Charlie Gito's has great Italian food. Fat Thai is great Asian food. So lots of places for you to stay and play, and lots of tournament opportunities as well. If you want more information, we're going to put a link to the entire schedule on our blog on thechipleader.com, the Final Table Show blog. We'll have a link to it. You can also like Harrah's St. Louis Poker Room on Facebook and get the information that way. We look forward to seeing you here. I'll be here pretty much every day. Dennis has got other things he's running around and doing, but he hopes to come in and play in a couple of these events. And we're looking for big crowds and great days here, December 1st through 11th at the Gateway Poker Classic, the very first ever tournament like this outside of the World Series of Poker circuit event in the state of Missouri, the Gateway Poker Classic, December 1st through 11th at Harrah's St. Louis.
Kids, are you caught up in that old game of shuffling your debt around and hoping you'll get lucky and win the jackpot? Well, it's time to deal. Mortgage rates are low and savings are high. So stop bluffing and call 800-GRANNY-8 or go to granny8.com. You bet our friendly loan officers make it easy, and we don't have an application fee. So call 800-GRANNY-8 and you'll be holding all the aces.
Great mortgage rates, call 800-GRANNY-8.
granny8.com.
This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show, brought to you by Harrah's St. Louis and in part by Homestead Financial Mortgage. For great mortgage rates, call 800-GRANNY-8. With Dennis Phillips in Las Vegas, I'm Paul Harris at Harrah's St. Louis Poker Room, and we're joined now by Rich Muni of the Poker Players Alliance. Hi, Rich. How are you?
Hi, Dennis. Paul, thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure.
I'm great today. How are you?
Good pleasure to talk to you. We wanted to bring you on to talk a little bit about what happened in Congress last week, but first maybe you can bring us up to date from the PPA's perspective on the developments with Full Tilt Poker and Absolute Poker and Ultimate Bet, and in particular the chances of those players getting some of their money that's been locked up online, getting that money back anytime soon.
Well, from the PPA standpoint, and of course from the standpoint of the poker community, we're committed to doing all we can to get players made whole in this matter. We have reached out to the Department of Justice in meetings from the PPA itself, and then the poker community, many members have taken the steps to reach out to the Department of Justice as well to ask them for assistance in the matter. Of course, we know they're, the group Bernard Tappy purchased of Full Tilt Poker. We keep hearing good news in the media. I'm kind of hoping that's able to go through, because that would represent the best way for players to get repaid as a result of that scandal, of course. So that's where we are as an organization, is that's kind of first and foremost, really, is to ensure that players are made whole from these three sites.
We have the response back from the DOJ, back to the gentleman that was with the bank in Utah and everything like that. And they made two allegations in it that I thought were very interesting. They said, number one, that poker is not a game of skill, that it is a game of chance, and that they alluded, if I'm correct on this, that the only difference between this is that maybe a few people with their practice and their skills and have increased their odds slightly. But it's no more than somebody going to the track and betting on a horse, and he knows which horse runs better in the mud.
So he may have a little bit of an advantage there, but it's still a game of chance. And any individual hand can be decided by luck. Therefore, the whole thing is luck. Can you comment on that?
Yes, I have had the pleasure of reading that analysis. We as an organization, of course, disagree with that characterization of the game as a game of chance. It is slightly affected by the skill of the participants. In our opinion, this is a game that in the long run is purely due to the skill of the participants. I think anyone who's actually played the game, especially if they played against somebody good, would quickly realize that it is very much a game of skill. But it's a legal pleading, and they're going to state their case, and it doesn't come as a shock. But the poker community has done its part to, and the PPA itself as well, to articulate the fact that our game should be seen differently from a house-banked game of chance. That this is a game where, with the proper application of skill, and that is a fundamental part of the game. It's not ancillary. For example, you could put a lot of skill into sports betting, but it's not necessary. It's not a necessary component of sports betting. You could certainly sports bet for entertainment. It's trivially easy to put a wager on on your favorite football team. You can't play poker that way. Poker is by definition a game of skill. We see it to be and we're not trying to say it's not gambling. By the dictionary definition of the term, but we definitely would contest anyone who characterizes it as a pure game of chance.
Well, as a follow-up to that, if I could, please, Paul, they're saying that any individual hand, can be decided by luck. Well, I'm sorry, but you can do that to almost any sports in the world. If the wind shifts when a left-handed batter is up there and it enables him to be able to pull the ball versus the bottom of the inning when it shifts back and takes a disadvantage away from it, there's a little bit of luck there. I have seen golfers hit a rake standing upright and bounce into a sand trap instead of onto a green. There is an element of chance in everything you do. How can they possibly say that because each individual hand is subject to chance, therefore the whole thing is nothing but a game of chance? I don't understand.
Yeah,
does that make sense?
They're going to make their case, and it's up to the other side to contest it. Of course, we do disagree. I understand how they can try to make the case. It's been done in courts before. PPA has gone to several court hearings, mainly to stand up for our membership when they get accused of a crime for hosting a game of poker, which we would see as something that would not be breaking the law in most areas. But sometimes they get charged on something that hadn't been charged in the past or something that's kind of nebulous in definition. So we've been able to help represent some of the defendants in these cases. And sometimes the standard case that the opposition tends to make is that a single hand could turn on the final card. Therefore, everyone's just putting their chips in the pot based on luck. We have a different interpretation that in the long run, that luck component peters out relatively quickly until the thing that remains is the skill component. It's just a standard function of standard deviation. It's just a relatively standard statistical study would kind of show what really happens. And your point is apt when you compare it to some other activities. I think a good example would be auto racing. If you look at an auto, you blow an engine any time in an auto race, and does that reflect on the skill of the driver? When you look at I'm an engineer, I'm a mechanical engineer. When you look at the design of an automobile engine, there's a lot of statistical work that goes into getting it as light as possible, and they design it with some risk of failure. They know some percentage of the engines are going to blow, and that's a trade-off for getting the lightweight, high-power component they need to run the race, and there are various trades that are made. And if you design something with a 5% chance of failure, are you gambling, on that risk of failure? Fighter jets are designed the same way. So if you had an air show that featured actual fighter jets, you know, would you be looking at the same thing? Of course, those aren't going to fall out of the sky. They're designed with a much higher tolerance. But the fact remains that a lot of day-to-day activities are predicated on acceptance of some degree of risk. You drive to work as some associated risk to it as well, especially cumulative over the years.
Yep.
And that should be well taken by everybody, is that, you know, if you look at the game of poker in the long run, we all get the same cards in the long run. It's nobody gets pocket aces more than anybody else over a large sample.
Right.
Anybody
who doesn't understand that there's luck involved in all sports should just look at the Rams' record. Somehow they won two games this year, and that was not skill. All right, enough about that. Let's talk about Congress, which last week held two hearings related to the licensing and regulation of online poker, and I guess online gaming in general, but online poker specifically. Thursday there was a hearing in the United States Senate Indian Affairs Committee, and on Friday the United States House Subcommittee on Commerce, Manufacturing, and Trade. That's the Mary Bono Mac committee. They held another hearing. Did anything positive come out of these things, Rich, or are we just hearing the same questions and answers over and over again with no progress?
We're actually seeing a great deal of progress. What we saw 2 years ago in these hearings, they're still debating if this is something that should be done. And now we've really seen a shift in that paradigm to how would you do it. And it does look like some things are, you know, there's an impression that some things are slowing down. But the reason about it is that now all the different stakeholders are coming up and making themselves heard, and it's understood that there's going to be some trade-off going forward, which is a good sign. It just means that, you know, again, the paradigm has shifted. Some of the people who thought before that, oh, this is possible to ban it, I would prefer it that way, now are realizing, well, the poker community's not going to give this up. They're speaking up pretty loudly. The players are, and the enthusiasts won't just roll over. We can't get a worse law passed no matter what we do, and people still play poker every day. And if they don't pass it at the federal level, these guys are going to pass it at the state level. That's what they're telling themselves. So we better get involved in this and make sure we have our piece of the pie. And what we saw Thursday and Friday were some of these groups coming in. The Thursday hearing was excellent for us. It was not about poker players. It was about tribal interests. It shouldn't have. We barely could even be expected to be invited. We were invited because the poker community has really stepped up and let these lawmakers know that they want to be heard and they want to be their stakeholders, and we all expect to be active participants. And then Senator D'Amato, of course, was a member of that body, commands a lot of respect there as well. So when we went in there, it was almost as if we're just going to give the third rung, just give a little bit of testimony, but the rest of the discussion would focus on the tribal interest. But I'm happy to say the senator stole the show. He came in, really articulated our desires as players and as Americans, and he had a really good vision for how the tribes could participate in this fully, as opposed to just coming in and saying, all we care about from a player standpoint is X, Y, Z. We said, this is how, you know, the tribes could participate and how the Indian gaming interests would benefit from this activity. And that was the part where he really shined, and the hearing kind of coalesced around the senator's statements. It was quite impressive to see. It was just I can't speak highly enough about the outcome of that hearing. The neat thing there.
Mm-hmm. No, go ahead.
I was going to say a neat thing there was that was our first time in the Senate since 2003. Poker was there in 2003, and the only discussion was how to ban our game, and that bill passed the Senate 90-10. Fortunately, it didn't become law. It was prior to PPA and prior to poker players really contacting our lawmakers on a regular basis. And these guys just kind of thought they were going to really show leadership by stopping what they thought of as a scourge of online internet gambling. And didn't. So to go from 90-10, not just a vote against licensing, but a vote for an active prohibition, to just 8 years later and just 6 years after the passage of the EGIA bill in 2006, to be in a position where they're talking about how we're going to actually license it and permit it and authorize it was just a real huge change of the position of the that body, and we're really happy to see it.
Well, there's been such massive changes in the U.S., a lot of it on a state level. I mean, and not just on the online, but in gaming and in general, with so many more casinos coming on, so many more states participating. I think Massachusetts just gave permission for 3 casinos. Texas, believe it or not, is next year going to have some sort of a little resolution to kind of put a feeler out there for its constituents to see what they think of it. Nevada passing for preparing the regulations and everything for online to try and be at the head of the field here. I mean, there's massive changes all around everywhere. And you have billionaires now stepping up there that want to get involved in this. When you have a Steve Wynn and some of his cohorts wanting to get involved in online gaming, they carry a lot of clout. Is there any chance of this getting passed in the next few months, or will we have to wait till after the elections of next year to have any chance at all of it getting passed?
I think there's a chance of having it happen in the next few months. I'd probably like to see something happen probably in the first 4 months of 2012. After that, I think election year politics will start to take over what's going on. But we thought the same thing in 2010, and Harry Reid came up with something in the lame duck session, and it didn't pass into law, but there was a lot of discussion on it. We're anything but dead. So anything can happen. Right now, yeah, the federal government knows that if they don't act, the states are going to do it for them. You referenced a little bit about Nevada talking about licensing for intrastate poker. And California and Florida and New Jersey are all taking a good look at it as well. I believe Congress knows if they don't take some action, they're just going to be, the states are just going to take the action for them. So, yeah, this thing, it might just come out where it doesn't look like much is going on, and all of a sudden, maybe a Senate bill comes out, or maybe the House bill just suddenly starts going forward as well. So there are a lot of opportunities here. I was going to say real quick, the second House hearing, the one we held on Friday, was very good for poker as well. A main thing that's going on is poker players are doing a great job of reaching out via the social networks. They're going to the lawmakers' Facebook pages and Twitter pages. If you go to any of our Twitter accounts and just sending them a lot of tweets, if you go to any lawmaker's Facebook page, you will see a poker post on the first page of every lawmaker, every senator, every representative. The community is very active. We're hearing back from our lawmakers that some of the top letters, when they rank the letters they get, one of the top issues is poker. Every single lawmaker will tell you we're in the top 10. And I'll leave you the final thing here on this one, was that when Representative, speaking of Texas, Representative Pete Olson out of Texas, a Republican, stood up at the House hearing, and he prefaced his remarks by saying the poker community has been very active. He said they're sending him a lot of, they're just crazy on his Facebook page. They're tweeting him left and right, and they've sent him a lot of emails and made a lot of phone calls to his office.
Well, it's good to hear that people are responding and being proactive in contacting government. I just feel, I made a prediction on this show a few weeks ago that we would not have legalized, licensed, regulated online poker in the U.S. until 2014, because I don't think they're going to get it done before the end of this year. We're hearing the same things that we heard last year with the lame duck Congress. Oh, they're going to hurry up and do it. Congress doesn't hurry up and do anything. And then next year you've got an election year. So even if it passes in 2013, it would take a year to get the rules written and the regulations and the licensing and all that sort of stuff. And so we're probably looking at 2014. And now we're hearing from the Office of Congresswoman Mary Bono Mack, who heads that subcommittee that I mentioned in the House, that they haven't even scheduled a markup of the Joe Barton bill. So, I mean, they're not really proceeding forward here. They're having the hearings, and we are hearing good things about online poker proponents like Al D'Amato, like Barney Frank, like some of the others who are sitting down there and doing that. But every one of these hearings is taken up by the guy who's an expert in problem gaming, and the guy from the tribes, and the guy from all of these other special interest groups who want to have their voice heard as well. And they're not even getting to the core issues of how do we do it, how do we regulate it, how do we license it. And not only that, but Rich, who's going to get taxed here? Are the poker companies going to get taxed? Are the poker players going to get taxed? I haven't heard word one of that in any of these congressional hearings. Have you?
the taxation is not in the Barton bill. That would be a companion bill, and that's really why it's not been discussed. Most of the discussion centers around the idea that the sites would pay a tax, and then the players would just be paying income taxes, and there would be enhanced, you know, reporting. So it would probably result in a an improvement in compliance by winning poker players. So that's where the numbers are coming from to date, but that's why they're not discussing the specifics, is because it's not in writing at this point. As to the other points, all the interest do have a seat at the table, so they are coming up. I mean, a lot of the tribes do have compacts with their states, so they're very much stakeholders, so they're going to be heard. They have a very strong lobby on Capitol Hill. I mean, that's why the Senate hearing was at the Indian Affairs Committee. So, yeah, it's expected we're going to see those. These are actually good signs because, again, we're seeing how it would happen. So I'm encouraged by that. In terms of the bill going through, yeah, of course, we've always been underdogs. But look at 5 years ago, the House voted for UGA by a 3-1 margin when it was H.R. 4411, which was a bill that actually banned online poker. It was watered down a bit before it passed into law. So in five short years, you know, to go from that to this type of discussion is extremely positive. Yeah, things look, there's going to be some discussion on how to really make sure it's done right. There's no question about that. What we need to do as players is just keep the push on, and enthusiasts, and just as liberty-loving Americans, even the ones who don't care about poker at all, should care if government thinks they should tell you what you can do in your own home with your own money. So I hope everybody would just reach out to their lawmakers and ensure that this is going forward. And that's all we can do. As we develop, you know, the momentum for our position, that's when we could see something like what you mentioned with the lame duck session in 2010. It didn't go through, but it was almost like a 50-50 shot. Of course, we ended up on the wrong side of the 50-50, but you get enough coin flips and we'll get one of them.
Well,
unless we have a serious case of the run bads. Dennis, I've got 1 minute left. I'll let you have the final word.
Well, just a quick thing. I'm hoping that we see some planks in some of the platforms of some of these candidates. I know that Senator Bennett, when he signed on with the PPA and came out in support of this, was an underdog up there in Colorado by a couple of 3 percentage points, and he ended up winning it by a couple of 3 percentage points. And I hope we had an influence there. I flew up there and helped him at one of his fundraisers and the whole bit. They are such close races now that I think this could be an integral part of a number of different elections if we keep getting a response from the poker players and everything and can actually make a difference. Can we see a platform or a plank on these platforms, do you think?
I think we could see a lot of improvement here. What we saw last election in the Bennett-Buck race that you mentioned was we clearly shifted this over, and we made it known to both candidates when it was done and to the media that poker players did take that credit for doing that. Jim Leach in 2006, when he lost in Iowa after sponsoring all these anti-poker bills, he cited us directly in stating that we were directly responsible for his loss. And cool. To expect us to be very active in 2012 as well. We're going to be putting on that same push.
All right, if you want more information on how you can support this effort, you can go to theppa.org. That's the Poker Players Alliance website. Rich Muni, thanks so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Rich.
Okay, thank you for having me.
All right, Dennis, we're off for another week, and by next week we'll be getting primed for the Gateway Poker Classic here at Harrah's in St. Louis. What are you doing? Got any travel plans between now and then?
You got some things going on in Vegas. I'm actually going to stay here, I think, for a number of days. Do go to Reno for a weekend for the Heartland. They've asked me to run up there to the Pepper Mill, and I will be down in Oklahoma for the first Native American Poker Tour. And again, I qualify, you do not have to be a Native American to play in this. It's just being held at those casinos. And Card Player is putting that one on, the guys over there. So those are the next two events that I'm going to be going to. And then, of course, down to the Bahamas for the PCA with Poker Stars in January. So that's kind of my outline of the next month or so.
All right. Have a great Thanksgiving. And on behalf of all the winning poker players in the world, we'd like to say to all the losing poker players in the world, thanks for giving your chips to us. Have a great week.
Ouch.
This is the Final Table Poker Show, brought to you by Harrah's St. Louis, every Tuesday at 3 on 590 The Fan KFNS at KFNS.com, and our podcast available on iTunes and thechipleader.com.